Welcome to Signs of Life, a podcast about life and literature and lots of other stuff. We're your hosts, Jen
and Elisa.
Welcome to episode 24. Today we are discussing books and why we read them. But today, Elisa, our producer, Rashida, is absent. She is apparently hang gliding in Mexico. And without her here to keep us in check, we may end up talking about a few other miscellaneous things as well. So we'll see what happens.
That Rashida is such a daredevil.
I know. And what would it be like to be like a globetrotter?
Kind of. What would it be like?
I'm a little jealous.
She'll have to tell us all about it next time. Mm-hmm. All right, Jen, I have a query for you.
A query.
Season 2, we introduced queries.
Yes.
All right, here's my query, Jen.
Okay.
Is it okay to hate a fictional character?
Oh, yeah. Don't you think?
All right, done and done.
Well, don't you think?
Well, it came up because my second oldest son has just started the fifth Harry Potter book.
Oh.
And I was kind of prepping him for it. I love Harry Potter. I just love Harry Potter.
Does he know, has he seen all the movies?
No, he hasn't.
So he doesn't know.
No, he doesn't know what's coming. So I was kind of prepping him for some things about the fifth book, things to be paying attention to as he reads, like the idea of civil disobedience and when that's okay. And I also prepared him that there is a character in this book. I don't need to speak in veiled terms here. I mean,
most people probably are familiar read with it or are going
to. So Dolores Umbridge is in book 5.
Oh yeah.
And I prepared him for the fact that there is a character in this book that he is going to hate. And I told him to be thinking about that as he reads, like paying attention to how much he hates this character, which I don't know if he's going to hate her as much as I do. I remember feeling kind of alarmed by how much I hated this character when I was reading the book the first time.
Really?
And I was thinking about that, like what that looks like to feel hatred even for a fictional character, and whether it's okay to sort of nurse a feeling of hatred, even if what I'm directing it towards is fictional. Because we talk to our kids about, this is the reason I wanted to have the conversation with my son, because we talk about loving people, that you can hate things, you can hate behaviors, you can hate injustice or abuse, but you don't hate people. And so even if that person that you're hating is fictional, is it cathartic? Like, is it an opportunity to experience a feeling of hate in a way that doesn't actually harm anyone? Or is it wrong because it's like practicing hatred?
You know what I mean? Yeah, I don't know.
But you answered readily when I said, is it okay to hate a character? You said yes.
I did say yes. You make some really good points. I read that Charles Dickens, was it you that told, I don't remember. I'm totally stealing this idea from something I read or someone I talked to. I feel like I
probably not me, because I don't like Charles Dickens particularly.
Well, is it because you don't like that his characters always seem to kind of have redemption at the end of their stories?
Oh, that wouldn't have been me.
That wouldn't have been you?
No.
Yeah, there's like this, it's like the his stories are depressing typically, but then at the end there's always kind of this opportunity for the villain to be redeemed and to sort of right his wrongs or her wrongs. A little bit, I guess. Maybe not completely, but there's that element.
Huh.
And so I feel like there are opportunities to practice, like, I don't know, like hating someone who's meant to be hated, like Dolores Umbridge.
Uh-huh.
Or Bellatrix Lestrange. Uh-huh. Or, you know, I don't know. I feel like...
Whoa, Jen.
What just happened?
I don't know. There's a football game in our room.
What? Back to my brilliant thoughts.
Yeah, sorry that Thursday night football just interrupted us.
Our Charles Dickens conversation we were just having.
Which, by the way, that was very strange. It's like there's a ghost in one of the computers in this room.
Yes. Yeah. Well, anyway, so actually, I really, now I don't know, because I feel like you did make a very compelling point, but I do love that fiction, regardless, is a really amazing way to experience a lot of different things. I have a query of my own, Aliza.
What? It's a double query week?
It is. Well, you know, our producer isn't here. So
we're going crazy.
We're going crazy.
Two queries.
Yeah. So this one is not as formulated, but it's been something I've been thinking about this week that I thought I would run by you and see what you think. So I have, I've mentioned many times on this podcast, that I have a lot of thinkers in my life.
Uh-huh.
And when it comes to kids and what you expect from children, I wonder if what I've noticed with all of the thinkers that I know is that respect is like top of the list,
yeah,
in terms of what they expect.
Uh-huh.
Even from other people, respect is like their number one priority.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally generalizing here, but it does seem to be pretty common. Whereas I'm noticing that as a feeler, and I think it's the difference between thinkers and feelers, I know that respect is important to me, but I don't have that gut reaction to disrespect that a thinker does. Do you know what I'm talking about? So, and I do think it's a thinker feeler thing. Would you agree with that?
I do.
So what do you think of feelers? Like, for you, what gets that same reaction of like, that is completely unacceptable, I will not tolerate this behavior or this,
like, as opposed to disrespect?
Right, exactly.
Well, you know, this is interesting because there's that popular book on marriage, Love and Respect.
Yes.
That talks about how generally men's fundamental need is to be respected and women's fundamental need is to be loved.
Yeah.
And that we want both of those things, all of us, but respect is a higher need in men and love is a higher need in women.
Yeah.
And I think this comes back to the discrepancy in Myers-Briggs types. We've said before that thinking and feeling is the only one where there's a gender discrepancy, and 70% of men are thinkers and 70% of women are feelers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think love and respect is less about men and women and more about thinking and feeling. And it just so happens that most men are thinkers and most women are feelers. That's kind of my working theory at the moment. And so I would say lack of feeling cared for.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like maybe when you see another child acting towards another child in an unloving way, like in a mean way, or when you see someone being, I don't know, I want to say a lack of justice maybe is something that I...
Yeah.
But that's love too. I mean, that's not necessarily a respect thing. It's more about...
Yeah. So how are you, what's the question regarding children? You would say that thinkers dislike seeing disrespect in their towards themselves or towards other children?
Towards themselves.
Okay.
Because I've noticed that kind of immediate reaction to disrespect in thinkers that I know. And just, you know, correcting it immediately. Like children will respect adults, kind of a thing,
uh-huh.
or at least the authorities in their own lives. And and it just made me think, like, okay, so I wonder then what I react like that to, because I know I don't react that way when one of my kids disrespects me. I mean, I don't like it.
Yeah,
I don't like being disrespected, but it doesn't have that same. It's not, I don't notice it as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I almost want to figure out what's going on in the relationship first, as opposed to demanding respect or expecting respect or whatever, however, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I think, you know, and I have kids spanning a variety of ages,
mm-hmm.
so I'm thinking kind of more about my older kids here, but I think... Yeah, respect isn't the highest thing for me. Just like you're saying, I don't have that... I don't like being disrespected by them, but it's not the same kind of gut-level response of negativity towards that.
Well, your husband's a thinker. Do you think that when he sees disrespect, that he is pretty quick to jump on that? Or no? Or...
You know, I don't know... That's a good question. He's pretty measured in his responses to things. Like, he doesn't react visibly. He reacts patiently. I'd be interested to ask him that question, like how he's feeling on the inside in those instances of disrespect. But I think my reaction does have to do with just meanness in the kids. And whether it's towards each other or whether it's towards me, which they're not mean to me often, but
I can't just imagine that with your kids.
They're good. But, unkindness or, I don't know. It is kind of different with parents and children than with, like, my relationship with my husband or my friends or other peers. Because there is that element of respect across the board that, you know, our kids need to be demonstrating towards us. But do you know what it is for you?
Well, I've been thinking about it, and it's hard for me to put my finger on it because I feel like respect is such a defined thing, I guess. And I was trying to think, you know, based on what you said with love and respect, I'm like, but what aspect of love is it that bothers me if they're not upholding that? I think what really upsets me is if I feel like there's a lack of empathy towards their siblings. They just don't care how the other sibling feels at all. Because I know they don't really, I don't think a lot of kids have a lot of empathy towards their parents, although I could be wrong about that. Maybe my kids just don't have a lot of empathy towards me. But, you know, it's when they're fighting each other and they just don't care at all about the other child's feelings that boils my blood. So I would say, and I wonder if that's, again, kind of, like, I react quickly to that and want to get put a stop to that as quickly as possible. And I noticed that the thinkers in my life, like, that's how they react to disrespect.
I bet you're right.
Yeah. So I'd be interested to hear from some other people on that one, actually.
Well, Jen, it's October.
It is.
It's that time of the year where people take their beautiful homes and try to make them look as tacky as possible. By covering their front yards with fake spider webs and dead bodies.
And cemeteries.
And spiders. And inflatable pumpkins.
The people catty corner across from me have a ginormous Grim Reaper hanging. Maybe it's not a Grim Reaper, but it's like a shrouded skeleton hanging, like, in the full length of this, like, 20-foot archway leading into their home.
Do your young children love it?
They think it's awesome.
Do they?
No, they don't. Okay. No. I was so nervous they were going to have nightmares, actually.
Yeah, my oldest son is old enough now to not really be, like, actually bothered by it anymore, but for years when he was younger, every Halloween, he'd be like, Mom, why do people put those things in their yard? Like, it just did not make any sense to him, and it bothered him. And there's a beautiful home near us that just got built recently, so it's all very, like, bright and shiny and new, but I just drove by the other day, and the fence in front of their house, every post of the fence now has a skull on it.
Oh my goodness.
So that's special. And there's a house down the street from us that is, like, practically literally a mansion. I mean, it's gorgeous. And it's got, like, ghouls poking out all of the fences now. So I know a lot of people decorate for Halloween, and I recognize that there are some potentially cute ways of decorating for Halloween, and I do enjoy fall decorations. I don't really do that up myself too much, but pumpkins and hay and things like that. Like, I like
cute little fall scarecrows with welcome signs. I might have one of those by my front door.
There you go. But besides, like, fundamentally being opposed to celebrating, like, you know, darkness and death and evil by decorating my house and covering it with those things, I just think it's tacky.
So I grew up and I was homeschooled, and we did not celebrate Halloween when I was growing up. The first time I really ever experienced celebrating, I'm revealing how much of a dork I am right now. But anyways, you know, we we went to, like, harvest festivals and stuff at churches. And it's all, like, fall decorations and things like that at those events. I didn't have any strong feelings about it either way until we started having kids, which I think is just kind of natural. But the more that time has gone on, it's like I want to find the balance between, like, letting my kids totally get dressed up and have fun and participate in the neighborhood and stuff like that to, I mean, goodness gracious. I mean, there's that house, and then the other house across the street from them has a giant spider web in their 24-hour archway, and they have these huge parties. And I know people think Halloween is, like, their favorite holiday of the whole year, and I cannot relate to that personally. I just can't. Like, I love fall, and I like pumpkins. I like kind of decorating in a way that maybe would be, like, I don't know, cross holiday. It works for Halloween and Thanksgiving. Trans holiday. I just don't get it. I cannot begin to understand why.
That's what it is. I don't get it. And I'm going to say I'm not opposed to Halloween. And you said about being involved in the neighborhood, that's one of the things I like about it. Like, yeah. Halloween, for some reason, is a holiday that draws people out.
And of their homes, yeah.
It is fun to get to interact with the neighborhood. And I don't want to be the person that shuts my doors and refuses to interact with my neighbors. Like, exactly. I'm not opposed to Halloween and trick-or-treating on October 31st for a few hours.
Right.
But an entire month of corpses.
So now we're going to talk about Elise's favorite topic, which is
Halloween decorations.
yeah, it's our favorite topic. Our words of the year.
Oh, our words of the year.
Yeah. I have to tell you, listeners, that I've tried to talk about this subject a couple of times now with Elisa on the podcast since we started up again, and she keeps putting me off. And so finally, we had an honest conversation about the word of the year. Conversation actually started back in the spring when you said what about your word to me.
I don't remember what
you
said.
You were, like, less than enthused.
Oh. Well, yeah. I think I, like, came up with a word because I felt like I had to come up with a word, not because I was inspired.
Because I pressured you.
Because Jen bullied me into it.
Well, your word was purpose.
Yeah.
And you just have not been a fan. So do you think it's more about the word, or do you think it's the practice itself, or what do you think?
Well, yeah, so I've been giving this some thought, and I really don't know. I've been trying to think, like, maybe purpose was the wrong word or too general a word. Although I can't even think of an example of a more specific word that would have been better than that. And so what I keep coming back to is that I think it's more the whole idea of it. For some reason, it hasn't stuck. Like, it's just not something that I'm thinking about when I make decisions or when I'm choosing how to use my time. It's more like, after the fact, I can look back and say, okay, how have I seen this word at work? And I can kind of force it.
Yeah.
But it's not something I'm thinking about as I'm making decisions. Whereas I think for you, maybe it is. Like, I think your word has sort of been inspiring to you this year, yes?
Yeah. Yeah.
And your word is action.
Yes. Which I think would lend itself to more, I don't know, like, I made this word my word, so I guess I better do what I think I should do. Like, I don't know, you know, when I'm reluctant to do something, or, you know, if I feel like I need to be motivated, or, like, since giving birth, I've been really focusing on, like, actual self-care, not, like, indulgence, because that's a big thing for me, too, is I like to stupidly indulge myself, which we could talk about some other time, but it's really ineffective, whereas self-care, if I'm doing the things that I know will actually be good for me, it's, you know, it changes everything for me. I get energy, physical energy, and I've healed more quickly from this birth because of all that. But normally I don't do those things. Uh-huh. And so that word of action has, it's like literally every day I was like, I need, this is like what I've committed to. I've committed to this kind of a life where I'm going to do it. And so it did help a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the nature of the word itself, like I said before, or if it's, because I mean, I did kind of like say, hey, let's do this. So it was an idea that I was very attached to, and I had a very clear vision for what I wanted. Whereas you were maybe not quite there with it. Now, have you done resolutions before?
Yeah, and I have them in a little notebook, and just the other day I came across them, and I was like, oh, yeah, these. Because same thing, I haven't come back to them. And so I'm wondering if there's a personality component to this. I was thinking about our personality types and, like, what might be connected to that. And I'm wondering if it's that second letter, the S and the N. Because as an S, I'm thinking about, like, what is in the here and now and what I can take in with my senses. Ns, like you, tend to be more idea people, more, a little more in their heads. And, as you've mentioned several times, S's are sometimes known for being shallow or something. So maybe this is...
Because I'm a big fat B, anyways.
Maybe this is an example of that, though, because I wonder if, as an N, for you, you're, like, percolating on the idea more, whereas I, like, like, came up with a word, but then moved on.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think... I think when I'm making my decisions and moving forward, it's based more on the present and what needs to be done and not like an overarching theme for the year. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. Yes. I had a conversation with someone recently that was saying that, I think she was an ISFP and she had an INFJ friend. And she would hang out with this person and they would have these amazing conversations. And then the ISFP would walk away and be like, that was such a nice time we had. And then she would kind of just move on with her life. Then her INFJ friend would call her like weeks later and she had been like mulling this conversation over in her head and would like want to revisit it with these new thoughts and like developments in her perspective on life because of this conversation, whereas her eyes up pre-front was like, wow, I just kind of like went home and thought we had such a nice time together, and then I cleaned my kitchen. So I kind of just, it was great and I loved it in the moment, but then I moved on with my life. Whereas I do think ends, it was so perfect. We totally get stuck, and the idea of a word throughout the year to propel me forward has, I think you're right. I think it's totally, it could totally be that SN thing. I'd be interested to know if other like S's have had success with New Year's resolutions or if it is more N's that do that.
Yeah.
If that's just something we, if we landed on a brilliant discovery here, or if we're just.
Or if it's hogwash.
Right.
But if we're right, we need to write a book.
We need to write a book. Well, we just. Don't steal our idea, listeners.
Yeah. Copyright 2017, Signs of Life. All right. Well, Jen, today we wanted to talk about books, as you said, and why we read them. And this conversation was kind of spurred by coming across an article. And we will include the article, a link to it, on our website. Our website, of course, is signsoflife.com. And the article that started this conversation is called It's Okay to Forget What You Read. It's by Charles Chu, and it was posted on medium.com. And the title caught my attention because this is something that has often concerned me. I was an avid reader when I was younger. I read quite a bit, and I think occasionally I read things that were a bit beyond, like they might have been at my reading level, but they weren't necessarily at my cognition level, if that makes sense. So there's a lot of books I read in high school, for instance, that now, a number of years later, I may look back and remember very little of what I read, and that concerns me. There's a handful of books that if someone says, have you ever read such and such, I might be able to say, well, yes, I read it, but I would not be able to give any particulars about the book anymore. Like, I really don't remember the book. Yeah. And that's always bothered me. Like, what was even the point of reading that book if I can't remember? And is there something wrong with my brain, or is there something wrong with the whole idea of reading these things in the first place if we're not going to remember them? I don't know. Have you had that experience?
Yeah. Well, you know, we go to the same book club, and we discuss books we've just read. I mean, there are times where I was listening to the end of a book on audio on the way to book club. And we'll get there, and you actually, it's so funny that you're saying that you don't remember things, because I feel like you, I don't know if you take a lot of notes when you read the books you're reading, or because you're going to lead discussions or what, but I think I walk away with impressions, and I don't remember details. And even just having read something,
yeah,
I remember like certain specific things that made a bigger impression on me because of their details. But the impression of the overall book is kind of what I walk away with. And it does bother me that I think there are things that I've read that have just transformed me in profound ways. And I think I just am like, wait a minute, where did I read that? I know I read that somewhere. And, so that, I don't know that it's, I wonder if there's a point to reading. I think I just get frustrated with my own ability to, I don't know, retain the specifics, like you said. Like,
now I'm curious, those impressions that you have, do you feel like those last though?
Yes. If I, well, there are books that are just forgettable. But if I remember a book, I'll remember why I loved it. Like, one of the books that we read in our book club was called All the Light You Cannot See, or We Cannot See. Mm-hmm. And see, I don't even remember who wrote it. All those things are, like, not important to me, which they should be. But, you know, I just remember thinking it was such a beautiful, sad book. And I remember, like, just kind of vague details about each of the characters. But it made me feel like there was a hopefulness to some of it, and yet, like, it's like those kinds of memories.
Yeah.
It, the, how I felt when I read it, or yeah, the kind of what I walked away thinking about certain events, or, you know, maybe not everyone in the German army was evil, and that, yeah, kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Well, and that is right. I mean, that's the gist of the article, and it kind of where, where we were going with this conversation is that even if we forget the details of what we've read, anything that we read does help shape how we think.
Mm.
And that was sort of an encouraging thing for me to think about. There was a line in there that said, even if you forget what you've read, its effect on your model of the world persists.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. To Kill a Mockingbird is an example for me, and I've reread that as an adult, and so I do have a clearer picture of the story now, although it's even since my rereading of it, it's probably been 10 years. But I read it for the first time when I was fairly young, and I remember liking reading it, like my impressions of it were positive, but years later when people asked about it, I realized that maybe I was too young to fully understand the concepts that were happening in it, or maybe I just read too much in the time since then that it kind of pushed out the memory of what it was about. But it was a strange one for me to be like, I know this book is a classic, people love this book, I've read this book, but I could not tell you what it's about. I mean, like, aside from knowing that there was a lawyer who was defending a black man against, you know, the prejudice that persisted in the area that they lived in. Like, I mean, that was kind of the only thing I remembered about it, which you can get from reading the back of the book. however, the idea that it's right to stand up for what is true and good, even in the face of injustice and prejudice, like, that value came through from the book. Like, I would have been able to point to that as a value that I learned from having read that, if that makes sense.
Totally.
Yeah. And I think about how many things are like that in our life. I mean, I do not remember all the conversations I had with my parents as a child, and yet those conversations shaped me and how I think about things and how I behave. Yeah. And you think about the hours that you spend reading a book, and of course they're going to shape you
Yeah.
Even if you can't remember them later.
Yeah. Well, and I think as you get older, like, there's a reason why as children, we read certain things, and a lot of the really great literature, I think things that are really worth reading will always have elements that are beyond comprehension at the point at which you read it. And then as time goes on, the impression or the kind of the memory of the impression or the overall theme of the story hopefully will go with you, especially if it's a really good book worth reading, and which I think is actually key to this discussion. Some books are just not worth reading. But if you've read something great and the connections that you could draw as time goes on, I feel like sometimes books, like, so I'm a big Charlotte Mason fan. She was like an educator, and we're homeschooling our kids, and I'm following a lot of her principles, or trying to anyways. But one of the things that she talks about is the living book, you know, and how books that are, there are books that are twaddle. She calls them twaddle. And those are things that are just kind of like, you know, for children, it's like a book that talks down to them or has a condescending tone or just doesn't speak to the child's humanity and ability to reason and think and feel deep, profound things. Whereas living books, even living literature for small children, I mean, it's like as an adult, those are the books that you love revisiting with your kids over and over again.
Yeah.
And that's why these classics have endured for time. It's because, you know, like rereading through the Chronicles of Narnia, I don't remember everything from those stories. Like, I remember I loved them so much, and I remember the beauty and the depth and the sadness and the triumph, and it's like those things have made an impression, and as we go through them again, I'm drawing more and more connections. So I think I love that her phrase of the living book, because I do think that things continue to grow in your mind over time.
Yeah, and you know, that was one of the points the author of this article even made, is that it, when we forget things we've read, those books that are worth reading, it creates room for rereading and revisiting the things that we loved the first time. And if we don't remember them well, there's a joy in coming back to that story.
Totally.
A second or third time.
Which I freely do when I love a book. You know that about me.
I do know that about you.
Now, do you reread as much as I do, though? Because I have read things like 10 times.
Right. No, and yeah. I think I would actually enjoy rereading. I'm not a fast reader, and the list of books that I want to read is so lengthy that there's just never time to go back and reread.
Yeah.
Because I'm not good at reading fast.
Yeah. So you're savoring your books, then.
I do savor the books, which I think we've talked about that before, too. I mean, there's any number of reasons for reading, and if you're not reading fiction, you're reading just for information and content, and so that's a time where it's of value to read quickly. In fact, my husband listens to a lot of audiobooks, and he goes through books so quickly, he has trained himself to listen to books on triple speed.
No way.
I am hard-pressed at double speed. I've listened with him a few times at double speed. And actually, it's kind of amazing how quickly your brain does sort of, like, get into that mode. Right at first, it sounds crazy fast to me, but within a few minutes, I'm in the rhythm of it.
Mm-hmm.
And his reason for that is he has read that our brains are able to take in information at a much faster speed than we read or than most people speak. And the reason our minds wander sometimes when we're listening to things is because there's too much time, whereas your brain is more fully engaged when you're listening to something that's fast. So if you're reading for information, it's a value to read quickly. But when it comes to reading fiction, especially good fiction, like you were saying, living books, I really do savor the words. And you mentioned the book All the Light We Cannot See. And while I didn't, the story itself didn't really stick with me in the long run, but I did do exactly that. I savored the words. I loved the way the author wrote and expressed ideas. And I enjoy writing myself. And so I think there's an element of learning from the style that a writer uses. I think I kind of study the way people put words together in hopes of improving my own writing. So there's that element to it.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes maybe that's part of the reason I struggle to remember the details, because I'm focused on the words themselves as opposed to necessarily the ideas.
Yeah. Well, and I think, so we talked in one of our first episodes about how I've kept a commonplace book. And, or people, so commonplace books are a thing, and then also, I guess you can keep, like, an index file, like, if you'd rather do something like that. I think, like, Ronald Reagan had an index file, I think I talked
of what?
About that. Quotes. So, like, oh. You, the commonplace book, and I've already talked about this, so forgive me for being... You know, repetitive, but it's
for people who are studying our podcast.
Right.
This is going to be so redundant.
Be like so irritated with me. you know, you take, if you're reading something, for example, like if I'll read, you know, my Bible somewhat regularly and fiction that's really good or a nonfiction, something that sticks out to me. If there's a quote that I come across that I'm like, oh my goodness, I really want to remember this. I really, really, really want to, you know, meditate on this. The act of writing it out is, for that specific section, is so helpful. And it's a great way to kind of keep track of things that you really want to remember. And you can record where you read it and all of that. But then also, I found that when I tell it back... to someone. So if I really want something to stick with me, I'll go and retell it to my husband.
Yeah.
And in the hopes of just remembering as much as possible and, you know, being able to revisit it in my mind. So
I think that's so good. I was reading somewhere recently about the importance of taking handwritten notes as opposed to typing notes because it actually does something in your brain that helps you remember more. And some of it is the time spent on the writing. But there's also the idea with handwriting that you can do something verbatim when you're typing because you can type so quickly. But when you're handwriting, you kind of end up this is when you're listening to something, you end up transcribing the idea, not just word for word.
So like if someone's dictating to you and
or if you're listening to a lecture or a talk, TED talk or whatever it is, like if you're listening to something and you think it's interesting and you jot a note down, you're writing down the idea, which means you've kind of translated it for yourself. Whereas if you're typing, you're just verbatim. You're not necessarily retaining it when you just do a word-for-word transcription like that.
Yeah.
And so, and then there's also the process. Even if you are writing verbatim, when you write something down in your own handwriting and you're seeing it in your own hand, you tend to remember something better than if you see it typewritten on a screen. And so that process of first copying down a quote in your own handwriting.
Yep.
And then taking that quote and telling somebody else about it in your own words.
Yep.
That really makes it stick. And I've been trying, because of this frustration that I tend to forget things, I've been trying to write down quotes. And even we've shared a few book reviews on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And when I write a book review, it's because I want to sort of solidify the ideas of the story in my own mind. That's part of my reason for doing it.
Oh, I love that.
Because when I walk away from a book, it's just so easy for it to sort of disappear from my mind. That concerns me.
Well, yeah. And when you do that, I mean, it's hard work. I feel like, you know, I expect my 7-year-old to do that with me when I read to him and then to talk back to me, to tell me the story back. Mm-hmm. I've done it for him. And it's hard work for your brain, and it's for a reason. I mean, it's your... When you paraphrase something back to someone, it's you're basically absorbing the information and processing it for yourself and then having to retell it in your own words. It means that you've owned that for yourself then.
Yeah.
So but it's hard.
And demonstrates that you understand.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's hard work for your brain.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's any books that you've read that you don't remember, but you know you have been affected by in some way? Like I mentioned, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah. Gilead is one that I don't remember a lot of specifics from it, but
and that's
that
another fairly recent one.
It is. I know. See, my brain is, well, part of, you know, I do have a newborn, so we're just going to throw that out there. It was such a beautiful book. It was such a beautiful book. I remember just underlining like crazy when I read that one. And I think it just made such an impression on me in terms of having a loving life and having a thoughtful, like just taking time to slow down and savor things and think about them, which I think is something you actually, we're just talking about, you do. You slowly savor the words you're reading. I do. I'm kind of more like your husband. I want to rush through to the next thing. I'm always thinking about what's next. And so I want... I think what I appreciated about this character was that, well, I don't remember all the specifics of the story even now. Mm-hmm. I do remember that I loved how slow and methodical he was about all of these things in his life, how grateful he was. And he took the time to think about all of that, to be grateful for it. So I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved that part of it.
So you and I have both, Jen, implemented ways to help ourselves remember things, whether it's the Commonplace book or whether it's writing book reports or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's a good practice, a useful practice. I think it has value. And yet, I think what I really landed on after reading that article and thinking about this further is what I also want to encourage our listeners with, and that is that reading has value even if you don't remember a book well later. I think what we read shapes how we think.
Yeah.
And whether or not you remember the particulars of any given book later, whether it's a fiction book or a nonfiction book, those are all adding to the structure of how you think about things. And so it has value.
Yeah.
Well, and we have a call coming through on the Signs of Lifeline, too. I wonder if our random caller has something to say about books and stories.
Let's find out.
Telling stories for me is about making invisible things visible so you can see the invisible things for what they are and have a better idea of how to handle them. So, for instance, if you're scared of something, you can tell a story about a monster and make the characters find ways to fight it, and then that will help you put the scary thing in perspective. It's something that can be tackled and can be beaten. Stories help us recognize who the villains are and who the heroes are in our lives, and they can give us a great perspective on gratitude and protectiveness for the things that are precious in life.
Well, look at that. She did have something to say about stories.
And she seemed to be pretty in line with some of the things that we were saying. And,
yeah. And yeah. Even in line with something we talked about last season, which was the purpose of fiction literature in particular.
Yeah.
We talked about liking fiction because in some ways it's like practicing for, like, when we read what characters experience when they come up against hardship, it's like practicing totally how we're going to encounter hardship in real life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like it was right in line with that. Thanks, random caller.
Thank you. That was good. That was great.
Well, Jen, do you have any drinks or winks or both this week?
I do. I have a drink at least. I've been considering my wink. I'll decide if I'm going to recommend it or not. My drink is actually a boxed wine.
Whoa, we have moved from canned to boxed.
We have.
We were recommending canned rosé last week.
It's just super classy.
We're getting classier and classier right here.
Yeah, it was like a red blend from Sprouts. And
is it a Sprouts specific?
No, I think it's called Boca or Boda. I'll take it. I'll link it on our page. But it's actually pretty tasty.
Uh-huh.
And it has a spout.
Classy.
And you just pour yourself this lovely glass of wine out of this box. And again, it doesn't, I mean, it's great. It's fine. Like, you know what I mean? It's not a terrible, it's nice. We'll just leave that. Leave that there. We'll leave that there.
Nice.
Do you have a classier drink than mine?
I don't have a drink this week, so no, you win.
Well, what's your wink?
My wink is Trader Joe's. I really feel like if Trader Joe's knew how often we recommended products from them,
they'd pay us.
I mean, they would. They would pay us. I think revenue at Trader Joe's is up 37% since our podcast started.
It must be.
I'm sure that's a fact.
Because I kind of buy as much as I can at Trader Joe's. And then whatever I can't get there, I'll supplement from other places.
Yeah.
But their candy and their treats and their wine and their yogurt. I mean, everything is so awesome at Trader Joe's.
It is. I feel like practically every week we've got something from there. And we do. But not this week. No, just kidding. I do. My wink is Trader Joe's chocolate. They have a lot of different chocolates that you can buy. Do. But they have some chocolate bars. And this one is in a green cardboard box. It's their Swiss 72% dark chocolate. And it's really good. 72 is fairly dark. Not super dark, but fairly dark. But it doesn't taste like chalky or grainy or overly bitter. Like, it's very smooth and sweet.
That's nice.
So if you like dark chocolates, I recommend the Trader Joe's Swiss dark chocolate in a green box.
Have you ever had the turquoise box with, like, the milk chocolate and hazelnuts?
Nope.
Oh, my word. So that's another really good one.
Do you know what, Jen?
What?
I do not like hazelnut in my chocolate, which is weird. I know, because a lot of chocolate has hazelnut. I like hazelnut coffee.
Yeah. Like, do you mean hazelnut coffee or hazelnut flavoring in coffee?
Hazelnut flavoring in coffee, I guess.
Like syrup, like a hazelnut latte?
No, like when you buy a roast that's like a hazelnut roast.
Oh, okay.
So, like brewing
hazelnut coffee.
Hazelnut coffee, yeah. But I've never cared for hazelnut in my chocolate.
Lisa.
I know, it's weird.
It is weird.
We went to Belgium once for just, like, a day, and Belgian chocolate is famous, but it all has hazelnuts in it.
Does it really?
Yeah.
I did not know.
I mean, not all, but...
But a lot of it does. Yeah. Well, there's Nutella.
Yeah, and, you know, I actually kind of like Nutella. I don't know what the difference is, because that's obviously hazelnut, but there's something about, like, hazelnut in chocolate...
Like,
I don't know. It's very specific. I know. I'm being like annoyingly specific here.
No, that's so funny.
But chocolate with hazelnuts in it. I don't.
Really? I did not know that about you. And I'm glad I know that about you now, because I'm not going to bring over like my awesome chocolate. I was just thinking as you were talking about this green box. I was like, I'm going to bring that next time.
Don't do it.
I'm not going to do that.
I'll spit it out.
Spit it out. That's great.
While we drink our boxed wine.
Well, thanks again for joining us for yet another episode of Signs of Life. We love you all and appreciate you. And bye for now.
Bye for now. This episode is brought to you by Show It. Are you stuck in a boring website template? Experience true creative freedom with the drag and drop simplicity of a Show It website. Get started for free at showit.co.